afternoon. Welcome, everybody, to the Council on Foreign Relations lunch. It's great to see you all in this beautiful venue in beautiful Montreal. I'm Irina Faskanis, Vice President of the National Program and Outreach at the Council on Foreign Relations, where I direct, among many things, CFR Academic, and I know many of you have participated in some of our webinars and events. And have taken advantage of all the wonderful resources that CFR and Foreign Affairs has to offer. So we have a fantastic panel for you today on geopolitics in the Middle East. Not a very narrow topic, I know. Very, very much, very broad. And I'm happy to introduce Lawrence Rubin, who will be moderating this discussion, and he will introduce our distinguished panel. Larry is an associate professor at the Samnon School of International Affairs at Georgia Institute of Technology, and he was at CFR as an international affairs fellowship. Middle East policy, so you can talk a little bit more about that. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Larry to continue the conversation.
Do you have the mic?
Oh. You have a mic.
Oh, yeah, I forgot. So clearly I'm not used to doing this, especially this nice theater, and I want to welcome everybody. Thank you very much for coming. I'm really excited about this panel. As we know, this is a very, really exciting one, too. Again, I'm Larry Rubin, and I will be moderating this panel today. This meeting, for all of you who want to know, is on the record, and we have here a very esteemed group of people we have from covering different directions. We have first, actually in the order, I'm going to actually revise this order a little bit. In the middle, we have Dr. Nicole Grayevsky, a Stanton Nuclear Security postdoc at the Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs, managing the ATOM project at Harvard Kennedy School, and she focuses on Russian and Iranian approaches to international order, with a particular emphasis on global nuclear order. This will be quite relevant for our conversations here. And as you heard, this is her area expertise and functional as well, and she's published on a lot of range of issues having to do with Russia, Iran, the Syrian civil war, and JCPOA, and so forth. Dr. Catherine Harold, we have here to my left, immediate left, Associate Professor of Public Administration and International Affairs at Syracuse University's Maxwell School of Citizenship and International Affairs, and she's currently a Fulbright Scholar in Serbia, and she can tell you about that if we have an opportunity. And she also served as a CFR Fellow in USAID, and also brings that type of experience there. And she uses ethnographic research with social science methods and looks at democracy building in the Middle East, particularly Egypt. And we have Dr. Stephen Cook, the Enrico Mattei Senior Fellow in Middle East and Africa Studies, and he's also important for everybody here, a director of the International Affairs Fellowship Program for tenured international relations scholars at the Council on Foreign Relations. I'm sure he'd be happy to talk to you about this. And he's also a columnist for foreign policy. He's the author of a number of books, and in particular, what hopefully you'll get a chance to tell you a little bit about, because it's quite relevant for this discussion. A forthcoming book, The End of Ambition, America's Past, Present, and Future, in the Middle East, and it'll come out later this year with Oxford University Press. So if you'd like more information on them, you can look at their bios, but this kind of gives you a sense to set the stage for where they're coming from and the different perspectives when I ask some of these broader questions. So let me start by very briefly the direction of this Middle East geopolitics. What is it? But to kind of draw you in a little bit, it's a very big, broad topic by design, in fact. And we wanted to take advantage, as I said, from the panelists' expertise and perspective to look at this and think about order and disorder both in the last last five to 10 years and moving forward and thinking about it. We know that order, we hear about it a lot. I'm sure if I were to take a poll, everybody here, at least one or two people from each table would have attended a panel that had something to do with order. We know a lot of us are. We also talk about this a lot in the Middle East, and as we know, it's sometimes used for stability, instability, and so forth, and sometimes it's a normative term. So we want to see and try to understand some trends where we were and where we're going in this way to get a glimpse of what this might look like. So I'll use the next hour to go into this a little more, and I'm going to start us off by actually turning to Nicole first, if it's okay, and I want to ask you, How do you think about, have you thought about regional order in the last 5 to 10 years, and specifically, given some of your, you know, your expertise and interests, how do you think the Iranian nuclear negotiations and the JCPOA and agreement and its breakdown affect regional order or in structure?
Well, that is a complex question. It's quite difficult to answer in 5 minutes. But I think when you think about the JCPOA and the Iran nuclear deal, there was an assumption that this would lead to a more amenable order for Iran and for the states surrounding Iran. But in reality, the agreement was a non-proliferation agreement. It wasn't about regional order itself. It was in order to stop Iran from acquiring a nuclear weapon. And this did not stop Iran's malign activity, and this is what a lot of critiques of the JCPOA brought up, is that Iran continued to act malignantly throughout the Middle East after the JCPOA. At the same time, the JCPOA was supposed to lead to some more discussions. It was supposed to be a starting point for more comprehensive discussions on regional security, which never really came to fruition. And of course, because of the Trump administration and their withdrawal, this kind of led to a breakdown of kind of relations in the region. You saw the exacerbation of conflict between the Middle between Iran and Saudi Arabia and the UAE. But things have changed, and I think another thing that when you're thinking about regional order is the role of external powers. And you've seen the return of Russia to the region since 2015, the involvement of China as recently as last week. And so there are dynamics that are changing, and I think it's kind of a broader view of it, I think, relates to the way the international order is changing as well and how power is becoming more diffuse. And you see more actors coming to the region and assuming mediation roles as well.
Okay, great. And we're going to get a chance to ask. I'm going to follow up, and then you all get a chance to ask some questions later, too. And now we're going to turn to Catherine a little bit. In thinking about how social and political order ties into regional order, we need to get a better sense, naturally, of societal trends. And how have the views about this link between democratization and foreign aid changed over the last 5 to 10 years, given what we've seen in the region?
They haven't. Unfortunately, and let me say why I say, or let me explain why I say unfortunately, Larry. Let me start just by going back to 2011 so that we all can recall the euphoria and the sense of optimism that was felt around the 2011 uprisings throughout the region, when there was great hope and expectation that democracy would finally settle on the Arab world. Civil society organizations rushed at the time to the front lines of democracy building, creating new projects around elections monitoring, transitional justice. They created academies of democracy. Western donors increased their budgets for democracy promotion in the region, and if they didn't already have a presence, they flocked to the region. Within 3 years, governments were cracking down on civil society, imprisoning activists, imprisoning NGO staff, shuttering NGOs. Western donors slashed their democracy promotion budgets. And fast forward to today, where NGO laws have institutionalized those repressions, those government repressions of civil society systematically. The US is turning its attention elsewhere, Russia, China. And China and Russia are both taking an increased political interest in the region. So, and meanwhile, democracy aid, to the extent that it's existing at all, has remained stubbornly resistant to change. This despite the fact that when we look closely at civil society and what is going on domestically, if we look beyond what we traditionally look to see when we think about civil society and democracy promotion, which is international NGOs like NDI or IRI or the Freedom House, et cetera, as well as domestic human rights NGOs engaged in technical projects related to procedural democracy, right? Legislative, judicial, electoral reform, and the like, if we instead look deeper and reimagine or reconceptualize democracy in a more participatory form of democracy that stresses things like discussion, debate, collective problem solving, free expression, rights claiming, and we look beyond those traditional NGO actors to more innovative forms of organizations, voluntary grassroots organizations, social enterprises or hybrid organizations, community philanthropy groups, we actually see quite a bit of quote-unquote democracy building work. Not called democracy building work, but certainly that participatory work around democracy building. And the question is, when will aid catch up to this?
Great, that's wonderful. Stephen, how would you, identify or define order the way the United States understands it, more practically, do you think the United States has contributed to order or disorder in the last 5 to 10 years? And that's probably another big question too, but feel free to take it.
Well, I'm glad you're asking it on the 20th anniversary of the invasion of Iraq, but we'll get to that. First, but before I answer the question, I just want to say first, thank you all for joining us here today as the only real home teamer CFR person on the panel. I just want to offer my welcome as well. I also want to say in my almost 2-decade career at the Council on Foreign Relations, this is the wildest venue for a panel that I've ever been in. And you'll have to excuse me, I may break into a Cole Porter song in the middle of this. It's like really rather extraordinary. The other thing I just want to mention before answering the question is, Larry was nice enough to mention the International Affairs Fellowship for Tenured International Relations Scholars. It's a fellowship that I direct. So if you have an upcoming sabbatical year and you want to spend some time at the federal government, working on a committee on Capitol Hill, or working in an international organization, it's a really great program. We've had a number of classes go through. It's very generous. There are brochures on the tables where you came in. I'm also happy to talk about it or find my email and talk about it over email. So I just wanted to make sure my deputy director would be really mad at me if I didn't mention any of those things. Anyway, Larry asked about kind of the U.S. conception or Washington conception of order. I want to go back further than the invasion of Iraq in 2003. I actually want to go back to 1991. And two important things happened. One in February 1991, and the other one the day after Christmas 1991. February 1991, of course, the United States prevailed in Operation Desert Storm, and on December 26, 1991, the hammer and sickle came down over the Kremlin for the last time, and poof, the Soviet Union ceased to exist. This generated a lot of interest in Washington, D.C., among policymakers, among people like myself, among our elected representatives at the time, what could the United States do with all of this power that it now had? And we looked around the world, we said, well, okay, we're gonna expand NATO, we're gonna engage in economic shock therapy, and we're gonna transform the Middle East. Everybody kind of looks at the invasion of Iraq as the original sin. It's actually a reflection of debates that went on for 12 years before that about what the United States should do with its power and how the United States should reorder the Middle East to make it even easier for the United States to advance its interests in the region. The conception had always been American predominance, and we had built an order composed of a variety of states. They were bastards, but they were our bastards. You know, if you ever read Gene Kirkpatrick's article from Commentary in 1979, but they were made up of the Egyptians, the Saudis, the Jordanians, you know, the whole crew. That made it even easier and less expensive for the United States to do the kinds of things it wanted to do in the region. But there was an important shift in 1991, starting in 1991, that kind of spanned the next 2.5 decades. Is that up until that point, Americans aspired to predominance, achieved predominance in the region, and sought to order the region to prevent bad things from happening. Basically three things. One, to ensure the free flow of oil out of the region. Two, to ensure no other country like the Soviet Union or some internal power could undermine the free flow of energy resources from the region. And three, helping to ensure Israeli security. That's it. Prevent bad things happening to those three basic things that were our core interests in the region. After 1991, it was, let's make good things happen in the region. Let's reorder the region. Let's do the kind of thing, make good things. Let's build a Palestinian state, which was not just resolving the Arab-Israeli conflict, but also during the Clinton years was a way to build democracy in the Arab world. The theory was that if the Arab-Israeli conflict came to an end, the rationales for the national security states of the Middle East would go away, which kind of betrayed how little these guys actually really knew about the politics. I mean, now I'm friends with a lot of them, so this is on the record. Yikes. Yeah. Okay. And then, obviously, throughout the 1990s, the arguments about Iraq. When it came down to it, though, the arguments about Iraq, there was enormous bipartisan consensus in Washington. The Iraq Liberation Act of 1998, Bernie Sanders voted for it. That's how much bipartisan support in Washington there was for this kind of thing. And so we were going to make good things happen. Obviously, Larry, that's kind of a canned question. Not think of 5-10 years. Have we created a more stable order that actually helps the United States achieve the goals we want? No, we've actually made it much more difficult for us, for some of the reasons that Nicole and Catherine have talked about here. That have undermined America's allies or partners, they're not allies, confidence in the U.S. commitment to security and stability in the Gulf. So we, and then have, by dint of that, have sort of opened the field for both the Russians and the Chinese, who are increasingly appealing to those people who helped us establish the order that we had established and help maintain our predominance in the region. I'll shut up.
No, that's...
Follow
that's,
up, please.
No, that's great. So I've got some follow-up, actually, that... my mic here.
Barry, we're not going to invite you back.
Yeah.
I can't speak for Arena, but I know I won't.
So the follow-up that I have... can you guys hear me? Yeah. Is one that's relevant for the news, and I'm going to switch this order up a little bit. Many of us have probably read about the normalization agreements between Iran and Saudi Arabia, and it's quite relevant for this topic here. So I wanted to ask about order in this way, and particularly we'll go first with Nicole, follow up with Stephen, what his perspective, and then come back from a different angle to Catherine. But first, kind of, as we have the resident expert on Iran and Russia and whatever else you want to comment on, what from their perspective are the gains and losses from this type of normalization agreement?
Well, Russia's been long trying to normalize ties between Iran and Saudi Arabia. It's no coincidence that the Saudi foreign minister was in Russia right before the agreement. There's been a lot of discussions about how Moscow is probably the biggest loser in this agreement, and I think that's actually to the contrary. For Russia, this is beneficial. It provides at least some degree of normalization between two countries that have historically had quite acrimonious relations. And also, at the same time, for Russia, it allows it to take a step back and not be responsible for enforcing this agreement. So there's a lot of political costs involved with the Chinese, because will the Chinese be willing to enforce this? Will they follow through on it? And I think that's the big question. When we're thinking about order and regional order and kind of the relations, like diplomatic relations and the establishment of diplomatic relations kind of can contribute to the more normalization of ties. It can contribute to communication. And so in the traditional sense, when we're thinking about statecraft and diplomacy, this is obviously beneficial, but to what extent, I think? But we do see this rise of China in the region, and I think that's one of the most interesting recent developments that we've seen, is that China actually took the initiative and got involved, rather than the United States or even Russia, which has sought to in the past. So.
Oh, thanks so much. And I'm going to turn it now to Stephen, actually, to see what are kind of your thoughts and thinking. You've done this, following American foreign policy for a while, the book coming out, and you have this potential disruption of order. Where do you stand on this?
Well, I think, first of all, I think what people have been saying is everything people have said about this and the Chinese role is true. The United States could never have done this agreement for some of the reasons that I talked about. that we have sort of undermined our role in the region by kind of the stupid things that we have done and have allowed the Chinese to play this role. In a sense, it's not bad for the United States for there to be de-escalation in the region. I don't think it's a bolt from the blue. The Saudis and the Iranians had diplomatic relations through years of frosty relations. But I do think it represents a fundamental change that I think many policymakers are struggling with, which is that now, after arguably 25, 30 years in which the United States had no competitor in the region, there are competitors to the United States. And I think that that's important. I think in many ways, Washington has lost its diplomatic dexterity to deal with this kind of thing. And that's why you have the massive freak out in Washington, or anything that you have said, anything related to China, you have goes like mass hysteria in Washington over these issues. I would say that, I've heard what Nicole has said from any number of people, and I think that's right. Like, it's now going to be up to the Chinese to try to, how are they going to enforce this? And how are they going to kind of push the Iranians on Yemen and so on and so forth? But I'm not an expert on China, but I've been doing a lot of reading on China for the book that Larry has nicely mentioned twice now, which actually I think at this point is going to be 2024, not 2023, because I read the last chapter yesterday and it's really not ready. In any event, it strikes me that the Chinese are serious when they talk about neutrality, and they don't want to be in between conflicts in the region. They saw the invasion of Iraq. They saw the freedom agenda. They saw how the United States has sought to resolve the Arab-Israeli conflict, and they see these as strategic blunders of historic proportions. And keep in mind that the Chinese get a whole lot of oil from the Saudis and the Iranians. So a de-escalation in the Gulf makes tremendous economic, and that's the most important thing to them, is their economy. That's the prime directive. And so ensuring that the oil comes out, of course, with the help of the US Fifth Fleet, and ensuring that these countries, that they do not get in between these two countries. And that's the danger, though, is that the Saudis have done this in a way where it puts the onus on the Chinese to get their pals in Iran to perform on Yemen. I'm doubtful that the Chinese can actually do that.
Great.
Or that they want to do that.
Right.
Both of those things.
And kind of taking it from a very kind of different direction, we've got these, talking about the nuclear order, we've got various aspects of big diplomatic politics, but we also have something that we know, as anybody studies the Middle East, is very relevant, what happens actually on the ground. And what do you think, I think you mentioned a couple of things that know that not much has changed in that way, but what should we be paying more attention to when we have all these big, larger discussions to other trends we might have mentioned here?
Well, Larry, let me pick up on something that Stephen mentioned, which is Washington freaking out about China, both in the region and beyond. And I'm not a China expert either, but my understanding is that at least a number of segments of Washington have framed global great power competition as democracy versus autocracy. And if that's the debate, and if the US is interested in promoting democracy, right, generally, and or as a counter to China. We can look at the most recent political intervention, but also China's Belt and Road Initiative. The United States is not going to compete with China on an economic basis. So how do we think, how do we reconceptualize promoting democracy, again, generally and in the face of global great power competition? And it's not going to be by promoting the US or the Western version of liberal democracy and trying to export that abroad, as we have so often done. But can we think, I mentioned earlier, and I'm happy to talk about more about what this looks like, but can we think, and international donors, to their credit, are thinking about this. I have skepticism of the efficacy of how these policies will play out. But can we think about supporting this locally born and bred, grassroots-based democracy building, rights claiming? Let's not even call it democracy. But the claiming of basic human rights and freedoms, can we support that? While, for example, China is brokering agreements between autocratic states or engaging in economic mercantilism. So just some thoughts.
Just let me pick up on that for 1 second. I think Kevin's right. This framing of the issue of autocracy versus democracy is one of the problems that we've had with our partners in the region that have actually led to this problem, perceived or otherwise, of the Russians and the Chinese, because the Saudis know that the Chinese or the Russians are not going to stomp up and down and scream at them and threaten them in a variety of different ways because of their human rights record.
Right.
And so what you hear from the Saudis is the politicization of human rights is a major problem in the relationship, in addition to a kind of narrative about, and this goes back to 20 years ago, a record of the United States, from their perspective, empowering Iran at each turn. So this framing of it, if you want to enlist your partners in the region to engage in great power competition, and this is an if, I mean, clearly Washington has decided that this is the framework for our foreign policy, you then can't turn around and say to them, this is about democracy versus autocracy, because none of them are democracies. And then if we beat them up about it, then they certainly don't want to sign up on Team USA. They don't want to sign up on Team USA anyway because they have too much to gain out of their relationships with both Russia and China.
Great. You know, and I will be very brief in my comments. What I find really fascinating, they are some of the same arguments that have gone on for the last 10, 15 years, and you would hear them on the ground in the Middle East. And it was always this thing of, oh, if you push us too far, we're going to turn to the Russians and Chinese as veiled threats, and people really called their bluff. But now it seems, you know, there may be more to it. Things may have changed. But now it's your time for all of you, or whoever, one of you, to ask questions to some of our panelists here. And when I do this, I'd like you to find a way to identify yourself to the person with the microphone and stand and state your name and affiliation, if that's possible, too. So who would like to ask somebody a question? Oh, we have.
Oh, the mics are just coming now.
Hi, Benjamin Tallis, German Council on Foreign Relations.
No relation.
No relation. Thanks very much for an interesting panel in an interesting setting. I just want to pick up on two comments that were made. One, the bundling together of US policy in the Middle East and the invasion of Iraq, together with NATO enlargement, not NATO expansion, but NATO enlargement. The role of the agency of other players is quite different in those two different cases. The desire of Central Eastern European states to join a voluntary sphere of integration is very different than the role or non-role of Iraqis in deciding to get invaded or not. So I think actually we need to be clear on that. The other point is that Chinese assistance doesn't come for free either. Doesn't come without conditions. So even though they might not be stomping up and down about democracy, then it does come with other concerns. That's all. Thank you.
Oh, thanks.
So I guess that was directed at me. Let me just say that I don't think I was implying that NATO enlargement and the invasion of Iraq were the same thing. What I was implying, or what I was stating, was after 1991, the United States had a surfeit of power in the world. And it decided it wanted to change the world. And among the things it wanted to do to change the world was transform the Middle East, make it more democratic, Pacific, all of those things, as well as expand NATO. Now, it may not be that, I don't think that nobody in the Middle East wanted to be democratic. I think what we saw in 2011 is clearly that people wanted to be democratic. They didn't want to do it at the direction of the United States or the support of the United States. Again, I'm just saying at a level of abstraction, the United States had a lot of power in the world. And in the immediate aftermath of the end of the Cold War, NATO expansion was something that American policymakers from administration to administration were very keen on doing and pushing. There was debate about it. There was a fierce debate about it. But from George H.W. Bush's administration all the way through Clinton, it was clear that we were going to use our power to do that. On this other question of, yes, there are costs. If you talk to Saudis, Egyptians, Omanis, Emiratis, they're not blind to these costs, but they also know that unlike many African countries, they have resources that the Chinese need and want. What do the Chinese want? The Chinese want oil from the region, and they want to sell weapons, the weapons that the United States won't sell to these countries. That's a tremendous amount of leverage for the Saudis, the Emiratis, and a variety of others. You look at the Belt and Road Initiative, which 5 years ago everybody was talking about. It's not really as much of a thing as it once was, but clearly the building of an industrial park in the canal zone is important to the Chinese in the way that, you know, it's important to the Egyptians as well. But I think these countries have much more leverage than the countries, particularly in sub-Saharan Africa.
Catherine, did you want to add anything to that?
Larry asked if I'd like to add anything. Let's taking it down to a very, you know, where I always go is local civil society, and Chinese Chinese assistance doesn't come without conditions. One question I would ask foreign aid, you've asked a lot about foreign aid, is how do we think, or how do foreign aid policymakers and providers rethink conditions on foreign aid? Everything from application processes to funding structures to evaluations. I mean, these are big issues that I think foreign donors, again, working at the very domestic level, at the very local level, really need to reconsider. Not having no conditions on aid, but really reconceptualizing what conditions make sense when we're talking about local actors.
I'll add one thing on China and the costs associated with Chinese cooperation in the region or Chinese involvement. Both Russia and China have exported surveillance technology to states in the Middle East. They have contributed and helped these regimes sustain themselves during times of upheaval. And that's something that's actually very valuable for the states that are autocratic and those who are seeking regime survival. So right now in Iran, the Russians have signed multiple agreements with the Iranians on internet safety. You can see that the rhetoric within the Iranian laws right now actually mirrors that of Beijing and Moscow. So there's also that appeal, and I think that's really important when we think about the domestic implications of it, is that it does provide these regimes with a sense of sovereignty boosting and also technologies for repression.
Are you close to that one, or we have a microphone there?
A couple here.
I guess this young woman there. Sorry.
Hello, my name is Asya, and I'm with the Claremont Colleges. And I actually just returned from Riyadh not too long ago. I had a contract training with the Saudi Arabian military in diplomacy, and I have to say, please, if you could follow.
Can you speak
up,
a little bit? Oh, thanks.
Is it working now? Okay. I was just in Riyadh not too long ago. I had a contract training with the Saudi Arabian military, and I got to sit with a lot of high-powered generals. And I have to say, they're very angry at the Democratic Party, and they're banking on this upcoming election for Trump to win re-election. And when this news came recently, thank you for coming about the Saudi-Iran-China deal. It was shocking at first because, you know, the Saudi Aramco and the long traditional relationship between America and Saudi Arabia, and then this twist now with MBS and the fallout with the Democratic Party. And I said, I have to say that they're putting all their eggs in one basket, and that is that Trump wins re-election. And I saw that those who, of course, MBS is highly, highly popular still in Saudi Arabia. And Saudis are very upset with America for, you know, pushing on the Khashoggi, you know, inquiry and whatnot. And so, yes, I was shocked when I heard this news, but then it didn't surprise me. It was almost like a form of punishment and a slap in the face to America, you know. And then I said, wow, who's China when it comes to the Saudi, you know, relationship with America and whatnot. So if you could just, you know, sort of comment on, you know, being in D.C. I was in D.C. several years ago, D.C., but now I'm not in the circle. So what's the talk on the street in D.C. about, you know, internal politics and the fallout between with Saudi Arabia and whatnot? If you can comment. Thank you.
Thanks. I undoubtedly, Saudi Arabia is among the red states of the Middle East, where, you know, it's MAGA 100%. UAE is also red, Israel's red, Egypt is red, all of these states who are, you know, important partners of the United States. What's so stunning to me about that, particularly in the Saudi case, is what happened in September 2019, when the Iranians attacked Abkhaz and Khorezm, and Donald Trump said, well, they attacked Saudi Arabia, not us. I'm waiting for the Saudis to call me. Which in one, two phrases threw out 40 years of declared American policy throughout the Carter Doctrine as well as the Reagan corollary to the Carter Doctrine. And somehow, it's true, if you shoot someone on Fifth Avenue, people will still follow you. I mean, he did more to undermine Saudi security in that regard than any other president. They're also very angry at the Democrats because President Obama negotiated the JCPOA and President Biden has tried to get back into it. What I think is clear is that that is in part driving their ties with the Chinese and the Russians, because now there are alternatives, or seeming alternatives, to the United States. It strikes me that, in a way, Mohammed bin Salman is playing that kind of positive neutralism game that Gamal Abdel Nasser played in the 1950s, where he's trying to extract as much as he possibly can by leveraging our hysteria about China, our hysteria in Washington about China, or what's going on, fears about Russia as well, to his advantage. Now, the conversation in Washington on Saudi Arabia hasn't really moved past the murder of Jamal Khashoggi. There's been a lot, I mean, you know, the Saudis are basically, you know, it's very hard to have a conversation about working with an important country in the region because it's Saudi Arabia. And, you know, members of Congress, people in the administration, everybody wants to, you know, list all the terrible things that Saudi Arabia has done. There is a significant list there, but the question is, what is, and this is where, and to broaden it out, this is where, from my perspective, this is a perennial problem for the United States. If you're going to engage in this great power competition thing, you're gonna need Saudi Arabia to do it. So where we end up, and where I think Biden actually is moving, is in the strategically tenable but morally suspect position. And that has been basically American foreign policy in the Middle East for as long as we can think of it. The strategically tenable but morally suspect, because look at who our friends are. They're all morally suspect. None of them are democracies, none of them share our values, but they've been willing to sign up with us and help us achieve our goals. But the debate, the tenor of the conversation about Saudi Arabia and Washington is maybe just a notch below what it was, not, you know, in the weeks and months after Khashoggi's murder.
Great. You want to move on to the next one? You have comments. Good? Okay, I saw a hand up there, and I'm going to come back down here in a second. But the,
Hi. My name is George Shambaugh. First of all, I want to say I was a IIF for tenured IR faculty in 2017. Absolutely fabulous experience. I encourage everybody here to apply.
This is what I'm saying.
It's true. My question is about domestic politics in the region. So we're looking at political turmoil in Israel and a lot of kind of social backlash to what's going on there. We look at women in Iran. We look at other kind of social movements that are contemporary, right? This isn't the Arab Spring, but there is something else going on. And the question is really twofold. How does that affect our foreign policy? But what is it that not just the United States, but that others can do to help facilitate that component of policy change?
I think we know who this is directed towards.
George, thank you. So as I mentioned, so you mentioned the contemporary movements that we're seeing. Let me just back up and make a confession that when I drafted my first book that was on
democracy promotion and democracy building in the wake of the Arab Spring. Its working title was The Next Arab Spring. That got nixed thanks to a really good anonymous peer reviewer. but what I saw at the time was, as I mentioned just earlier, a continued grassroots mobilization despite government crackdowns, despite all of the gloom and doom that we hear out of the Middle East, this continued grassroots mobilization for freedom and for rights, not necessarily for democracy, right? And I think that's what we're seeing in Israel, it's what we're seeing in Iran, it's what I witnessed in Palestine, in Egypt, it's what we see globally as well. It's what I see in Serbia, just youngish people especially, but people of all ages, fed up with the with existing repressive status quos, or fed up with and or fed up with institutions that are not positioned to respond creatively and flexibly and innovatively to the challenges of the time, right? And we see people mobilizing in the streets, but also in much more subtle ways, in ways that are often built around social enterprise, that really don't look like politics at all, but that are very much about freedom, rights, and change. And so how do we support those from a policy perspective? As I said, to my mind, and when thinking about sort of US policy around foreign aid, it's about repositioning aid from that top-down trying to export US values and US strategies of democracy building abroad, and we were talking about this earlier, transforming a procurement model whereby USAID and other international donors procure contracts, right? Contract with organizations to do the projects that we want. How can international donors and international bodies support this local mobilization without tainting it, without professionalizing it, without corrupting it? Those are big questions that the international donor community is grappling with, but I don't think have the answers yet. There are some creative ideas within that donor community, but I think some real challenges that are going to be difficult to overcome. Sorry, that was a bit long and rambling.
No, that's great. You know, that tainting part is really fascinating. And if we can possibly turn to Nicole for some of the expertise on Iran, because I'm sure a lot of people want to hear it, or some of your broader thoughts, either of the two.
Well, kind of this follows up with the question is how has domestic upheaval impacted U.S. foreign policy? And I think Iran's a really good example of this. So after the outbreak of protests in Iran, basically U.S. policy shifted from being resumption of the JCPOA, involvement in negotiations with Iran, to really focusing on the human rights situation in Iran. And so you've seen the U.S. attention basically going away from resolving the nuclear issue to really the domestic developments in Iran. And so that's one way I think that these domestic changes actually do influence foreign policy, and I think the Iran case is pretty, that's a pretty salient factor right now that we're seeing in terms of U.S.-Iran relations.
I don't speak enough Hebrew to consider myself really an expert on Israel, although I've recently written on it. I think what's fascinating about Israel is the way in which it has been framed in the American foreign policy discussions for so, so long, so that when Israel kind of reflects some of the kind of pathologies about autocratization, I guess is what we would call it, you have a government that is trying to weaken checks and balances. You have ministers in government who are, you know, racist religious fundamentalists. It does not affect American foreign policy whatsoever. Joe Biden is still going to say, I got Israel's back. You do see interesting things happening. There was a poll yesterday, more Democrats now support Palestinian rights than they support the Israelis. You do have Democratic members of Congress talking about more openly about conditioning aid to Israel. That's the changing, there is a changing politics to it, but that has not yet translated into an actual fundamental shift in American foreign policy. There seems to, you know, the kind of old things that we say about Israel, not just the unbreakable bonds and the special relationship, but also the we share values kind of thing, even when we don't really. I wrote that recently. I got a barrage of really nasty emails from kids I went to camp with. But, you know, it's very, very interesting to see how Israel is constructed in the American foreign policy debate so that when things like this happen that, you know, compels the President of the United States to shift policy, JCPOA, to human rights, that does not happen when it comes to Israel. It remains the exception. The normalization of Israel into our foreign policy has not occurred.
I saw, Serge, do you have a question before? Oh, yeah.
Yes. Thank you so much for your time today. Paul Ashenko, Lieutenant Colonel in the Army, Council of Foreign Relations term member, and also the Deputy Director of the Cornell Tech Policy Institute. So great work by your Deputy Director, Steve. I've got a question about the Qasem Soleimani strike. I study drone warfare, and I'm just kind of curious if you could give us your sort of assessment on the implications of this vis-a-vis regional security order building. I mean, in broad terms, it seems to me there's two arguments. On the one hand, it was a predicate for war, but on the other hand, we really haven't seen the sort of outcome that critics assess would take place, at least as far as I can tell, not being a Middle East expert, but spending a lot of time in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Who wants to do drone warfare?
Yeah. Well, I mean, we were lucky with the Soleimani strike. I think that the fact that that didn't devolve into a larger and wider conflict was very fortuitous. The Iranian response was measured, but it also showed how things can escalate so quickly. And I think with the Soleimani strike, I'm not an expert on drone warfare. That's not really what I researched. But when it comes to the domestic reaction or the reaction within Iran to that, it kind of emboldened the regime towards a more uncooperative stance towards anything really involving any kind of cooperation with the West in general. But it also provided the regime with a hero and with a martyr. And so the Soleimani strike domestically is very important because it did strengthen a lot of the narratives around this kind of evil empire, you know, the United States, et cetera. But I think what is more significant when we think about could this happen again is actually if there's going to be a military strike on Iran's nuclear facilities. And that is what I think should be more of the attention rather than Iranian drone warfare right now. I think this is a plausibility that we could see a broader escalation as a result of this if Iran reaches 90% enrichment, which it's quite close to. So that's what I would be looking for when it comes to instability in the region.
My quick view on the Soleimani strike is that you kind of have to separate it from the drone warfare that the United States has engaged in the post 9/11 era. It, to me, it reflects this sort of lazy Susan quality of Trump foreign policy. So, like, you know, you spin the thing and whatever comes up in front of him is what he focused on for a couple of weeks. You know, it was Venezuela, then it was this, then it was getting out of NATO, it was whatever. Qasem Soleimani came up on the lazy Susan, and they said, Mr. President, we gotta do something about this. And then that was it. I don't see, it was seemed to me it was totally disconnected from any strategy in the region. Just remember, a few months before he said, the Iranians had hit the Saudis, and he said, I'm not doing anything about it. It's not us. I'm getting us out of the Middle East. And then he undertakes this strike, which, as Nicole quite rightly points out, threatens to become a wider conflict. It just made no sense. It was totally disconnected from any strategy in the region, and I think just reflective of the kind of inability of former President Trump, who actually, in an interesting way, asked some good questions about American foreign policy, but in practice, this was a totally incoherent thing, disconnected from strategy.
Okay, great. I have a question here and there. Is the young woman here?
Yeah.
Hi all, I'm Martha Elizabeth Phelps from the University of Nevada, Las Vegas. I wanted to touch base or go back to something Nicole said. Can we just talk about, you mentioned the cybersecurity in the region and drawing that to a regional ties and movements from that, and seeing with this movement to drone warfare, it brings me back to thoughts about like Stuxnet and the way that the nuclear industry in Iran is going that with enrichment. So I was wondering if we could just talk about cybersecurity for a moment, and with cyber attacks, and if there's that kind of regional, moving towards a regional hegemon about security there that you might have mentioned.
Well, in terms of the cyberspace, at least, my focus is on, I mostly have looked at that through the context of Russia and Iran, and there's been several agreements. I think it was in 2019 between the Russians and the Iranians on a cybersecurity cooperation agreement, and that's classified. So the contents of it are not known, but I would assume that there's a lot more effort right now, especially because of the increased Russian and Iranian cooperation, on fortifying not only their own defenses in the cyber realm, but also on finding ways to actually work together through their false flag operations and targeting intelligence services and also government infrastructure through cyber. I think cyber sometimes is, as we've seen actually somewhat in the war, is that a lot of these non-traditional technologies that we thought were going to take such a prominent role in the evolving nature of warfare don't actually appear as prominent as the traditional factors like military, arms, et cetera. So I think that that's a possibility. I know that the Iranians have, after Stuxnet, really focused on strengthening their nuclear security when it comes to cyber attacks. But we've already seen that the Israelis are quite have infiltrated Iran very, very deeply, and they do have intelligence operatives throughout the country. So I think that's also still a possibility, but that's another big question mark when it comes to Iran.
Great, I'm gonna actually try, we have about five-ish minutes left, and I know that about CFR, you end on time. I've been to enough events. So I saw a question here, and I've got one here, and we're gonna group them together and then have the panelists answer.
Thank you, my name's Heidi Hart, I'm professor at UC Irvine and also CFR. IAF Tenured International Relations Scholars Program. Thank you very much for that opportunity at the State Department. So I wanted to ask about the impact of the Taliban takeover on military aid towards the region. We heard a little bit from the panel about how we're seeing a refocus from the U.S. perspective towards Russia, China. Does this mean that, after, say, 20 years in Afghanistan, that military aid is changing fundamentally? This feeds into maybe some of the concerns that you also raised about corruption, fraud, and obviously how that, some of those kind of broader consequences. Thank you.
Thanks. And we're gonna add another question right here.
Thank you. Harris Milonas, George Washington University. I know Steve probably wouldn't be happy to live here without talking about Turkey.
Believe me, I'd be thrilled not to talk about Turkey.
But I mean, my question is, it's kind of absent in the conversation. I'm kind of surprised. I think President Erdogan would be surprised because he thinks he's running the region. So I'm wondering, what do you think are the ambitions? It seems like we're talking about a lot about what the US wants to do there, but there's some regional players, they think they run what's going on there, and I'm guessing you want to add something about this. Yeah.
Okay, great. And I think we can, let's go with these and we'll see if we have more time.
I'll try to be brief on the Erdogan question.
Okay, and then we'll go to...
And I can't really, I'll take a stab at Heidi's question as well. I don't sense that there's a slowdown in any effort to kind of ratchet back military aid to the region as a result of the Taliban. I mean, I think what President Biden has tried to do is to demonstrate to the GCC plus three, the plus three being Jordanians, Iraqis, and Egyptians, that we will give them as much stuff as they want because we want them on side. Regardless, there's certain things we're not gonna sell them. We're certainly not gonna sell them drones, but then they'll get that's the opening for the Chinese. I will tell you, the more interesting aspect of the Taliban takeover is that none of these countries want to hear about us on human rights as a result. Don't talk to us about human rights. Don't talk to us about women's rights. Don't talk to us about anything. You left, and you left the worst of the worst in charge. We had I spoke with an Arab foreign minister, a small group of us, not long after the Taliban takeover, and he said, what in the world did the United States do the months leading up to it, the Islamists in Morocco had suffered an electoral defeat. I mean, it was rigged, but whatever. There was the self-coup in Tunisia. The Egyptian Islamists had been on the run for years, and the AKP in Turkey was losing its regional mojo, and you guys let the worst of the worst off the hook. That has, in subsequent conversations and things that I have seen in trips to the region or talking to people when they come to Washington, has had a profound impact on the quality of our conversation with our partners on that part of the world. You're right, Harris. President Erdogan sees Turkey as, among other things, a leader of the region, and a Muslim leader. What has happened, obviously, is that the Saudis, the Emiratis, the Israelis, and now the Egyptians have all turned the tables on the Turks because the Turks overreached and really did believe that they could order the region, and everybody banded together against them and froze out the Turks, and now they've had to go, and this coincided with the economic collapse in Turkey. And where do you go when you need money? You go to the Gulf. Where do you go when you need money? You go to the Gulf. Where do you go when you need goodwill in Washington? You go to Tel Aviv. So that has been what they're interested in doing. And Erdogan has gone hat in hand. If you all thought the fist bump between President Biden and MBS was embarrassing or whatever, the S-eating grin on Mohammed bin Salman's face when Erdogan had to come see him in Saudi Arabia was extraordinary. I laughed about it for days. And that's the situation that they're in.
Catherine, did you want to ask the first question about the
military?
Yeah, no, the democratization. I thought there was a question. Where was it? Maybe not. No. Any of the others?
Why don't we get the last question?
Yeah, we've got time for one last one, and I didn't see who was first. Yeah. I have to make this tough call. But do you want to? Let's go both of them. We can do it. We've got to do it half a second each if we can get there.
Thank you. I'm Hatem Zayed. I'm a PhD candidate at American University. I'd like to hear more about your reflections on public reaction to the deal, right? Like, how would sentiments on the street have an effect on what's going on, right? So, I'm Egyptian, and all my Facebook friends, right after the deal, there was, of course, some neutral opinions on, oh, this is good for Yemen, this might be good for Syria, but the overwhelming focus was, hey, this is great because we sidelined America, right? Like, there's an element of happiness that America is playing less of a role in the region. They see China as a neutral partner. And thinking from the flip side, right, how leaders of these states, if they're thinking of legitimation of their regime, there's an element of partnering with one power over the other might, you know, improve the views of their constituents. So how could, also tying that to aid, and aid is a reflection of especially bilateral donors, it's a reflection of the priorities of the state. How can these two things together kind of place the U.S. in that neutral position again, as opposed to a more biased power that the people don't want in the region?
Okay, great. And we'll add one more question to it.
Hey, I'm Carolyn Stevenson from the University of Hawaii. And I've heard very little about the role of women or women's rights on this panel yet. And our current program chair, Erica Chenoweth, and Zoe Marks from your institution have made the point that there is a linkage between misogyny and autocratic and authoritarian regimes, and that one of the things that we need to do in our foreign policy is to make central the question of the empowerment of women and women's rights and women's issues. I wonder if you could speak to that.
I'm going to take a pass on the second question, even though I went to Vassar, but I'm just amazed at how committed you are to come from Hawaii to Montreal in mid-March. That takes a lot of commitment. I was actually supposed to be in Saudi Arabia at the time that this was all happening, but COVID, guess what? It is real. But I will tell you that I have been in that part of the world when Lavrov has been there and spoken, and it's not just the people. It is officials. Our primary interlocutors are responding to the Russians and the Chinese in ways that our officials would find deeply disturbing. And I think it's because of many of the mistakes that I talked about going back to 1991. Rather than trying to prevent bad things from happening, we tried to make good things happen, and we failed at making those good things, and we failed spectacularly at doing it. And we were overambitious in thinking what we could do. And we're now, I think, paying a price for those last three decades of our foreign policy. And that's what makes, in part, that's what makes the Russians and the Chinese appealing partners, or potential partners, or partners also with the United States. I don't think, you know, anybody really wants Russian equipment now. They still want American stuff, but whatever.
Want to go and then?
On the domestic reaction to the Iran-Saudi Arabia deal, I've mostly just looked at the Iranian domestic reaction and then also the Russian side. But on Iran, I think it's basically similar to what you observed in Egypt. It was hailing the deal as basically the U.S. leaving the Middle East and saying that this was better. There was a lot of stuff about economic opportunities, how this is a beneficial thing, showing that the world is like the Western era is coming to an end. Obviously, it's a lot more flamboyant when it comes to some of the Iranian rhetoric, but that side, I think, and you also kind of saw something similar with the Russian response. So it is a way, I think, for countries that are historically have fraught relations with the United States to kind of portray it as a victory of like anti-Westernism. So that's what I've observed so far.
Well, and I'm not on the streets of the Middle East. I'm on the streets of Serbia these days, which certainly has a fraught relationship with the United States, and is never disappointed to see the West falter, as it were. But to the questions of how can aid be more neutral, and how can aid, for example, support women's rights? I will again go back to the international, or especially the Western donor community's push for localizing aid. But the question is, all right, how can that be put into effect? And one thing I would go to, when we try to think about being more neutral and being supportive of local priorities and local strategies for change, is to think sort of about our technical funding processes, rather, as I said, than procuring contracts to do projects. Can we work more in, for example, co-creation, co-creating projects with local partners, with hyper-local partners? Can we think about welcoming and encouraging unsolicited proposals rather than issuing RFPs for the projects that we want to see, and in doing so, learn what are the priorities of local actors, and how do those local priorities differ across states? Now, whether there's a real appetite to do that, because what do we know about foreign aid? Well, it's also about projecting, you know, U.S. interests abroad. And but if we are thinking about, all right, do we really care about supporting freedom and rights and projecting a more humble U.S. stance? How do we then we think about localization in a very meaningful way, which is really going to be a challenge for the international donor community in the coming years?
Listen, this has actually been a great way to wrap up this panel. And I wanted to thank all of you for your attention. I want to thank the Council on Foreign Relations. I want to thank the two older guys in the Muppets who are up at the top there in this incredible facility here. Nobody got that joke. But it's really been a wonderful discussion. I think some people may be around for a little bit more for follow-ups. I know we didn't get to everybody's questions, but thank you so much to everybody here for all your time.